It's not some science fantasy effect from 2001. This electronic display emanating from Australia's largest computer is a picture of the condition, past, present, and future of planet Earth. The program was originally devised by a scientist working from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Jay Forrester. It was developed under the auspices of the Club of Rome by an MIT research team to present a complex model of the world and what we humans are doing to it. The program, called World One, doesn't pretend to be a precise forecast. What it does for the first time in man's history on the planet is to look at the world as one system. It shows that Earth cannot sustain present population and industrial growth for much more than a few decades. It shows that simply cleaning up our car exhausts and making some small effort to limit our families simply isn't enough. It's like an electronic guided tour of our global behavior since 1900 and where that behavior will lead us. Well, this is the printed version of what we've just seen on the television screen. What looks at first to be just a maze of computer characteristics is really a system of very simple graphs which project what's going to happen to the planet over the next 150 years if we don't do something drastic to stop it.
Hello, I'm Chris, and welcome to Foundations in Social Innovation. In this module, we're going to explore different ways to model systems so that we can build a shared understanding of how they work, of how they change over time, and ultimately to spot opportunities for action. We're going to be drawing on a few different bodies of knowledge to do this: soft systems theory, systems thinking, systems dynamics, theory U, and socio-technical transitions theory, to name just a few. You've just heard about the first attempt to model the world as a system. We're also going to hear about road safety in Sri Lanka, homelessness, and rock and roll. This podcast is being recorded on unceded Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and future. So systems modeling can be simple and quick, but it can also get incredibly complex as you try to represent the complexity of systems themselves. Something you can do with a sheet of paper, with a few bodies in a room, or through complex computer-based modelling. The good news is that you can get a lot of insight into a system, even from a simple model. And because there are some common ways that systems behave, if you learn to identify those, you can see them reoccurring again and again in the world around you. Now, previously we've looked at program logics, and they tend to take a look at systems in a snapshot of time. But systems change over time, and because of those non-linear relationships between elements in a system, that can make how systems behave hard to predict. And that's where models come in useful. They can help you understand what causes that change and identify places to experiment with new actions in the system. We're going to look at five kinds of modelling, and I think they're all really complementary to each other. I don't really see any good reason why you couldn't use them all, although some may fit better with the context and the people that you're working with than others. The first model we're going to look at is a rich picture, something from soft systems methodology in the 90s. And it's a quick and simple way of modelling systems that with some analysis can get to the structures of systems and underlying mental models. The second is the iceberg model. Now, this model connects the visible, observable parts of the systems, the stuff above the water, with something invisible, the structure of the system that sits underneath the water. And it's something that grew out of anthropology in the 70s. The third model we'll look at is actually a set of models, some alternate ways to think about the structure of systems, the bit of the iceberg that's below the water. And we'll compare models put forward between the 80s and the 2010s by Daniela Meadows, David Stroh, Peter Senge, including the Water of Systems Change model developed by Senge with FSG. Then we're going to tip our toe into the water of systems dynamics with Daniela Meadows. We're going to look at feedback loops and how feedback loops combine to create a number of common behaviors in systems known as archetypes. The fifth model we'll look at is an embodied form of systems modelling, where people themselves act out the system and the dynamics in it, literally as a group of people in the room. Specifically, we're going to look at 4D modelling, one of the set of tools connected with social presencing theatre, which itself is connected with the theory U approach. And finally, we're going to zoom out to look at how systems transform over time, decades or centuries even, with a focus on the MLP model, the multi-level perspective that underpins a lot of the research into transition theory. And we're going to hear from one of its creators, Frank Gehls. And a lot of these are visual models. And I don't know if it's a bold idea or just foolish to try and talk about visual models in a podcast, but there are some pictures on the website if you want to follow along. Let's start with rich pictures. In 2018, Taxi worked with the Citra Social Innovation Lab in Colombo. For one of their first projects, they were considering working on ways to reduce the number of road traffic accidents on Sri Lankan roads. To get started, each member of the team drew what is called a rich picture of the current situation. Now, the idea is that when you draw a rich picture, you literally create a big picture on a big piece of paper of the system in focus. You include in it as much detail as you can, the tangible and the intangible elements. You show how different things are connected. You show the tensions in the system. You think about the legal and the illegal things, the formal and the informal aspects of the system. And the idea is that when you've done that, you've got a complete picture of the complexity that holds a problem in place. There are about 7 people on the Citra team, and no 2 pictures were the same. It became clear that if they were to do a project on road safety in Sri Lanka, they'd need to include consideration of alcohol usage, of police corruption, of the bureaucracy around licensing, religious holidays, access to vehicles, road maintenance, and much, much more. Seriously addressing the problem would mean keeping all of this on the table and not sweeping it under the rug. So a few folks, a few systems thinking gurus have claimed that children are natural systems thinkers. And so I thought I'd try out a little experiment to see if that was true. So this is my son, Frank. He's 6.
My name is Frank. And today I'm here to have an interview with Daddy.
That's right, that's right. And do you know what we're talking about?
Systems?
That's right. And do you remember what a
system... And we're talking about systems.
And this also involves our dog, Marshall. She's 3. And so for the experiment, I used a really simple systems thinking framework called the iceberg framework. So the idea with the iceberg is that in systems, just like with icebergs, only the smallest part is visible. And the majority, the really important part, the bit that's going to get you, is below the waterline. It's invisible. In the iceberg framework, the observable facts about systems sit above the waterline, and the invisible aspects sit below it. Above the waterline, at the very top, you can see events. The next level down from events are the patterns and trends, and below the waterline are the structures. The mindsets, the practices, the policies, the relationships that you need to change if you're going to change events for good. So I explained all of this to Frank, and we thought we'd apply it to our dog, Marshall, to answer this very important question. How can we stop Marshall whining? I wanted to see if Frank could use a systems thinking approach to determine how we could reduce the instances of whining. So in this example, whining is the event. It's very observable. Well, you can hear it. It's the tip of the iceberg. So I asked Frank to think about the patterns and trends that sit below the events. When does Marshall whine?
Marsha whines when she's hungry or wants a walk or needs to go to the toilet.
Okay. That's the patterns and trends level. And now we need to dive down a little bit deeper under the water into the invisible to think about what caused that. How is it structured into the system of our family? And what could we do to shift that situation?
Maybe walk her to the Oval and back every day.
And how do you think we could make that part of our routine?
Maybe by getting me used to the Oval.
And what about on weekends? Because quite often on weekends you don't want to take her for a walk.
And you or Mummy could take her for a walk.
But is there something you could change about yourself, do you think, to make it more likely that we would take her for a walk?
Maybe we could get something special if I went to the Oval.
Oh, you'd get a treat?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It can be anything. Food, drink, or toy.
We agreed that in order to reduce whining, we'd have to take the dog out more regularly and perhaps earlier in the day.
Oh yeah, what kind of special
And that the
place?
Problem was held in place because we were often too busy to take the dog out first thing in the morning, and our mental models prioritised work or getting to school on time over the dog.
Every time you come and take the dog for a walk.
But on weekends, when adults had more time, Frank was a little resistant to going for a walk. So we agreed that we'd need to try some experiments where we took the dog out first thing in the morning to see if we could change the pattern of events further up the iceberg. And I'll be reporting on this very important experiment in upcoming episodes.
Okay.
Conclusion so far?
Well, let's talk about some other systems.
Children are natural systems thinkers.
You're a bit closer to the microphone.
And I can link you to some great resources if you want to try it out on your own kids, nieces, nephews, or grandchildren. We can also use the iceberg framework to analyse far more significant events. The killing of George Floyd by police in the USA is one tragic event and injustice. It's the tip of the iceberg. And it's a tipping point in a series of events and ongoing examples of police racism and brutality and killing of black people. Those are the patterns and the trends. And the resulting call from the Black Lives Matter movement is to restructure the system, to work below the waterline, to shift resource flows, to defund the police, and to invest instead into the development and transformation of black communities.
The Uluru Statement from the Heart is an invitation to the Australian people from First Nation Australians. It invites all Australians to walk with First Nations peoples in a movement for a better future.
In his books, David Stroh is an advocate of identifying the two or three highest leverage points to set in place a cascade of changes across the system. And that's exactly what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities have done in Australia with the Uluru Statement. Developed through a participatory process, the statement calls on Australian people to embrace three changes: voice, treaty, truth. Three levers in the system: a voice to Parliament, a treaty with the Australian government, and a truth-telling process. The most helpful framework I find for unstructuring and restructuring systems is something called the six conditions of systems change. And it was developed by Peter Senge with the American not-for-profit FSG. The framework names the invisible elements of systems and provides a starting point for mapping the relationship between them. Let's go back to our iceberg model, and we're talking exclusively below the waterline here. So just below the waterline are the somewhat invisible things. Policies, practices, resource flows. You can observe them. You can see them if you know what you're looking for, and they might well be written down somewhere. Changes in policies or practices and resource flows can be significant, but they're not as significant as the changes at the next level down. There, deeper in the murkier water, are relationships and power dynamics. This is what the Aboriginal community want to change through a treaty and a voice to Parliament. But below this, deeper in the water and imperceptible from the surface, are mental models underpinning everything. Change mental models about the past or the future, and you can change anything. And I think through a truth-telling process, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities want to change white Australians' mental models of history, of our role in perpetuating injustice, and our perception of who owns the land on which we live.
Down the left-hand side of the graph is the date, 1900, 1940, 1980, 2020, right down to 2060. Now, each of these lines of letters represents a curve showing some aspect of the condition of the planet. The further out this way they go, the greater that figure is. The further this way, the less. For example, P represents population. So here it is at 1900. And then it comes up to 1940, it starts to take off. Here we are at 1980, up to the turn of the century, and then it starts to peter off. Let's now have a look at this next curve, the Q curve, which is the quality of life. And this is represented by, for example, the amount of space people have, the amount of money they have to spend, the amount of food they have to eat. Now, it increases rapidly up to 1940, but from 1940 on, the quality of life diminishes. And here we are about the turn of the century, and we come up to the year 2020, and it's really come right back. More people, of course, means that you start to chew up your supply of natural resources. And this is this curve here, the N curve. And it shows that slowly but steadily, the pool of natural wealth in the world, natural resources, minerals, oil, and so on, is slowly but steadily diminishing. So this is the situation. As population increases, the quality of life decreases, and the supply of natural resources decreases. But have a look at this curve here. This is called the Z curve, and it represents pollution. Now, predictably enough, as the population increases up to 1980, pollution increases. There's more rubbish. But from 1980 to the year 2020, pollution really takes off. This is assuming, of course, that we don't do anything about it. So the year 2020, the condition of the planet starts to become highly critical. And if we don't do anything about it, this is what's going to happen. The quality of life is going to go right back to practically zero. Pollution is going to become so serious, right out here, that it will start to kill people. So the population will diminish. Right back here, less than it was in the year 1900. And at this stage, round about the year 2040, 2050, civilized life as we know it on this planet will cease to exist. Well, hopefully, of course, it won't be allowed to happen.
Systems dynamics is a particular school of systems thinking that looks at modeling causality in systems, how one thing causes another to change. For example, what you were just listening to there in the 1973 world model that modeled, using systems dynamics, the relationship between population growth, economic growth, natural wealth, and quality of life. It was a model built by Jay Forrester and Donella Meadows, and we're just about to hear from Donella Meadows. It's one of her lectures, and she's explaining the philosophy behind systems dynamics, and the mysterious sound in the background is her using a blackboard.
Okay, today I'd like to talk about the system dynamics method. In particular, the philosophical aspects of that method, not the mathematical. Next time I'll get into the mathematics and into the computer programming aspects of system dynamics. But today I would like to try to tell you what I regard as the essence of system dynamics as a philosophy for learning about complex systems. And it is a philosophy. I want you to understand that this is going to be a difficult task for me to do. It's kind of like describing the lenses in your eyes, which you never see, you only see through. System dynamics is called dynamics because it deals with how systems change over time. That is, there are a number of different modeling schools that can be divided into static or dynamic. Static models try to express something about a system at one point in time. System dynamics is interested in how systems change over time. And so anytime I see a graph of some behavior of a system with time on the horizontal axis, I get excited because that's the kind of a system that a system dynamicist can maybe say something about. Okay. So let me start with causal linkages. You saw last time in the deer model that I started each model by a causal diagram where I just made arrows showing what I thought was connected to what in the system. And that's typically the way a system dynamicist begins thinking about a system. We don't always succeed, but we try in including in our models relationships that we think are truly causal. That is that when we make an arrow from one element to another element, we think we can explain the actual mechanism in the real world by which element A causes element B to change, causes. That is, we're trying to get at a mechanism that truly exists, linking those things, so when one thing changes, another thing changes. And you should be able to ask a system dynamicist, what cause do you mean by that arrow? And he should be able to tell you what mechanism he had in mind. In fact, ideally it should be very clear and you shouldn't even need to ask. For example, if we write, as in the deer model, births influence the population. That's not only causal, that's almost definitional. It's so obvious. As soon as a deer is born, it's a member of the deer population, right? And there's a plus sign there, meaning that more births give you more deer. And that should be, ideally, in a system dynamics model, any relationship like that is so causally obvious that you hardly have to question it. And let me distinguish that approach from another one, which you will see in several kinds of modeling later, which is a correlational approach, in which the elements in the model are not necessarily causal, but are simply correlated. And that means that two elements that are connected in the model vary together in some way, but not necessarily because one causes the other. They simply are associated together. Now, it has already become apparent to you that I discover feedback loops everywhere I look. Discovered a bunch of them there that I hadn't even intended to put on this graph. I can't resist finding feedback loops. I see them everywhere. That is, again, part of system dynamics. We expect the world to be made up of closed chains of causal relationships. We look for it, therefore we find it, not surprisingly. We probably make them up when they're not there, but we also like to think that the ones we put in are there in the real world. The image of the world that we carry around is not essentially there's an input, there's a big black box where a lot of stuff happens, and then there's an output. That is an image of the world you hear in a lot of political speeches if you kind of listen. It's what I call an open system view of the world, open loop view of the world. You push something and then something comes out. What we look for is a relationship like this. And now I will put up on the board ultimate feedback loop, the basic feedback loop, which we think every subspecific case is an example of. And that is, there is something we'll call the state of the system. This is some measurable, visible indication of how the system is, how it's behaving, what condition it's in, what its quality is. And then there are actions or decisions or changes designed to alter the state of the system. Okay? And this is the politician's point of view. I'm going to do a policy and it's going to change things. Okay? I'm going to build roads and it's going to decrease highway congestion. I'm going to build new housing in the cities, and it's going to decrease slums, etc. This is the visible part of the system. It's the part where human beings are acting in order to change something. There's also, in our point of view, an invisible part, which says that those are taken on the basis of what the state of the system is. There's some information that causes the decision to be what it is. And that completes the feedback loop. And this dual relationship we always are looking for. When somebody says he's going to change the system this way, we look for how the system is then going to feedback and change future decisions, future policies, future actions.
This kind of causal modeling of systems dynamics can be used at all sorts of different scales. I've used it to model the effects on young people of living in care and custody, and also how people end up living homeless. There's a whole visual language and diagramming style to it. What I find particularly useful is understanding the patterns that reoccur in systems. And they each have their own diagrams, but those diagrams can be hard to read. And the story is just as powerful, if not more so. There's 8 to 12 common patterns that are usually held up, each with a catchy name, as what are called the archetypes. And I'm going to share a few with you now that I think are particularly relevant based on the archetypes or the system stories that Senge explains in the fifth discipline. And the pattern here is that the people who do well in systems, whether that's an individual or an organization or a family, tend to have an advantage and gain more benefit from that same system. So if you're a fisherwoman who's particularly lucky with your fishing, you make a greater profit, you can invest in more fishing boats, and then you can outfish your peers. So that's one example. And of course, this is the pattern that explains inequality and how people who have wealth and money and advantage get more wealth and money and advantage. But the inverse is also true. You could call that disadvantage to the disadvantaged, or marginalization to the marginalized. So if you happen to be born into poverty or to a group that experiences marginalization, you're more likely to have poor health outcomes and poor educational outcomes, more likely to be exposed to trauma. And if you're engaged in welfare systems or criminal justice systems, they're likely to further stigmatize, disadvantage, or even traumatize you. This is the pattern behind intergenerational disadvantage and systemic racism. This next pattern is called tragedy of the commons, and it goes some way to explaining the environmental situation we find ourselves in. The pattern is that a shared resource is exploited, and unless there are appropriate checks and balances put in, for example, fishing quotas, then that resource will be destroyed. The next pattern is called shifting the burden. And sadly, it might just be one of the most common patterns you'll come across in your work trying to tackle social problem solving, particularly if you're working with existing systems. Shifting the burden is also known as the quick fix, and they happen when the symptoms of a problem are very visible, and then all of the attention and money is put on treating that symptom. And what's worse, it seems to work because the obvious symptom gets mitigated, at least for a time being. But in doing that, the root of the problem remains unaddressed and may even get worse. So a classic example here is people living homeless, particularly people living rough on the streets. It's a very invisible example, but it's a symptom of a much bigger and deeper societal problem. You can fix the visible rough sleeper problem quite quickly through temporary shelters, but that doesn't get people stable or long-term housing, nor does it address the much bigger homelessness problem, of which rough sleeping is just one part. I'll just give you the names of some of the other archetypes. Eroding goals, limits to growth, balancing process with delay, escalation, fixes that fail, growth and underinvestment. And there's links in the info section where you can find out more about these.
So about 7 years ago, I was invited by the Kellogg Foundation to help the community of Calhoun County, Michigan, where Battle Creek is the main city, where Kellogg is located, to help the community develop a 10-year plan to end homelessness. And the focusing question, basically what the community was concerned about, is why, despite our best efforts, have we been unable to end homelessness in Calhoun County?
This is a story from David Stroh, a former colleague of Peter Senge, and a story of using a systems dynamics approach to work on homelessness.
There were, at the time, about 250 to 500 people homeless in a population of 100,000. There was a homeless coalition that had been meeting for 10 years, but had not been making a lot of progress, in part because of the competition among the service providers, in part because of the lack of knowledge of best practices and disagreements about how do we actually go about doing this. There was an opportunity to receive funding from the state if they developed a viable 10-year plan. And what I and a colleague did is a systems analysis, systems thinking analysis, to complement the community organizing initiatives that were already underway. And I want to highlight two terms that I'm going to come back to in this introduction. Community development, community organizing, I think of as acting systemically. One of the best things that foundations can do is to be that neutral convener of lots of different stakeholders. However, bringing people together, getting the whole system in the room, is not necessarily the same as having them think systemically about the ways in which they are connected. And I believe that thinking and acting systemically are very powerful, complementary approaches. So what did that mean to think systemically in this case? So trends and patterns. The estimated number of homeless people had been increasing over time. Interestingly, the visibility of the problem had gone up for a period of time, but that was when the homeless shelter was in the downtown business district. So the easiest thing to do was to move the homeless shelter to a little bit on the outskirts of town, which reduced the visibility of the problem. And the other thing we saw over time was that the efforts to reduce homelessness had increased for a period of time and then had plateaued. So those were some of the presenting trends. Now, what about the underlying structure? Why were those trends occurring? So now we're going to start by looking at this idea in the dominoes that there's a problem or crisis. We take some action or intervention that produces maybe in the short run what we want it to produce, but then also produces some unintended and delayed consequences that often make the problem worse. How did that play out in this situation? Problem was homeless people. The solution in place, the quick fix, temporary shelters and supports. And that worked. You know, people, at least for a period of time, had a roof over their heads. They had some supports. And to the extent that the shelters and these other support providers were helping homeless people, they got more funding. I mean, we can demonstrate 100% bed utilization. That's great. We'll give you more money. So another factor in this was the donors. The donors' desire for seeing short-term results, because that's satisfying. We know we're helping now, back to that philanthropic challenge. When organizations were receiving funding to do what they were doing, they were not particularly willing, nor had the time, to innovate and collaborate. And it's that innovation and collaboration that was required to implement a longer-term but more fundamental solution, which was permanent housing with critical services for those who needed it. But when that funding, that willingness, that time was not there, and the investment in the permanent housing was not there or not sufficient, it further increased the number of homeless people. It was the dominoes. And there were some underlying assumptions or mental models that kept that dynamic in place. So what are some of the mental models that were feeding the dynamics in Calhoun County? First of all, the service providers. We've got homeless people. We have to help people now. Again, the service providers. Look, we deserve more funding. We've got 100% bed utilization. Think about this for a moment. How on earth can we end homelessness with 100% shelter bed utilization? You can't get there from here. And the donors thinking, look, we're contributing to tangible results now, and that's rewarding. And it is. The service providers, again, well, we've got to protect our own funding. And then the public officials taking a look at those time delays. Time delays are a significant part of complex system structures. They look at that time delay, they say, this permanent housing stuff, housing first, too expensive, too difficult to implement, and takes too long, can't really get behind it. And so the process keeps feeding on itself. I wanted to briefly touch base on the bottom of the iceberg and then move into how do you take this stuff home. Bottom of the iceberg is purpose. Now remember I said there's a difference between a system that achieves something and achieving the purpose you would want it to achieve. In the homelessness case, we can feel good about helping people cope with homelessness. We can reduce the visibility of the problem, out of sight, out of mind. We can reduce the severity of the problem. At least they're not under the bridge. And we can get funding for it. That sounds like a pretty good set of arguments to me. Does any of that end homelessness? Nope. Perfectly good reasons, but it's not going to end homelessness. I'm going to talk for a moment about the results, actually, of this. The plan ended up being funded. The leverage points that were identified by this analysis became the basis for the plan, for the goals in the plan. A very important thing happened. There was a breakthrough in collaboration among members of the Homeless Coalition. Whereas previously they'd competed for funds, the next time that HUD funding came into the coalition, all of the members of the coalition collectively agreed to funnel the money to the one shelter that was actually providing bridging, deliberate bridging, into more permanent housing. That means a lot of those other providers were willing to give up funding in service of the whole. That is a huge shift, thinking systemically, not just acting systemically. And I'll come back to that at the end. Finally, from a quantitative point of view, in the plan's first 3 years of operation, 2007 to 2009, which included the recession of 2008, homelessness decreased by 13%, eviction rates declined by 3%, despite a 70% increase in unemployment and a 15% increase in bankruptcy filings. So quite a huge impact on a quantitative scale as well.
And now for something entirely different. Next, we're going to look at the 4D modeling methods. It's from social presencing theatre, a group of methods that can be used and aligned to the theory you approach. And it's a much more spiritual approach. No computers, not really any paper involved. It's much more about how you can feel the dynamics in the current state of a system and how you can feel how you want those to change over time through embodying a system in a room with a set of bodies. This is going to be explained by Otto Sharma, one of the co-creators of Theory U, and Arowana Hayashi, one of the co-creators of social presencing theatre and 4D mapping.
So where do we use social presencing theatre, and in particular kind of the practice you are going to see in a few minutes from now? We use it in the co-sensing space, which the same activity we talked about before the break. And co-sensing basically is two things. Number one, you have to take a deep dive into the front line and the periphery of the system. Kind of that's kind of, you do that in a million different ways, kind of million different methods for that. But that's only part one. Part two is you come back together as a team and then you make sense together of all the different kind of golden nuggets that you return with. Now, what are the methods you can use for this collective sense making? There is like systems thinking, there's scenario thinking, there's a bunch of other useful methodologies. But in our practice, and we use kind of all of them in different contexts, but what we are more and more gravitating towards is using social presencing theater. For two reasons, as far as I am concerned. One is that it makes particularly visible the deep transformation structure of a social field, which otherwise you often tend to miss. And number two, it's fast. It doesn't take weeks or months. Time is money. We don't have money in our projects. We all know the problem, right? So we have like a finite amount of time. How can you use that finite amount of time to have deep impact? Well, social presencing theater, in our experience, is a methodology that in a relative short amount of time allows you to crystallize the essence of all this research that went on before in a particularly effective way. And for example, in China, I remember kind of having gone with a cross-sector group, but many from the public sector, through learning journeys. They went through prototyping initiatives. They did a lot of like then sensing journeys with all the stakeholders they wanted to engage, and then they make sense of that and kind of revise their the way they wanted to run their prototype. And it all felt wrong, right? So it's all the right things on paper, but it didn't feel like really transformative. It's like the old mindset, basically. And then we asked them to basically synthesize their stakeholder sensing activities around each of their prototype initiatives, which were groups of five, six, seven usually, in a mapping, right? Sculpture one, current reality, sculpture two, kind of emerging future. And that's, then it happened that it, you know, suddenly clarified what was wrong with the old social sculpture and why they needed to change their intervention. They needed to really rethink and reinvent what they want to do in terms of their prototype in order to transform the old system. I remember kind of there was one, the government in the center of sculpture one telling the citizens what you need, right? They never asked the question, so what they need and how they would, you know, get the services or the solutions for what supposedly was their needs. While in this sculpture too, kind of this central structure of the government and all the disempowered people was more moving to the periphery and holding the space for the other stakeholders to more directly interact and listen to each other and interact and co-create around these needs that got clarified that way. So that's like a simple example. But they, from all the talking to the stakeholders, they couldn't really bring all that together. They had the data, but they couldn't bring it together in a collective sense-making mechanism. So why SPT, why social presencing theater? Because it gives you immediately, and this thing doesn't take longer than 60 or 90 minutes, immediately you have a collective language and a collective perception of what's wrong and broken with the current system and what are potential pathways of moving it into a different direction. And if in a team of very different stakeholders with very different mental models, you have a collective language, an image as a reference point, so you talk about the same thing, because we all saw what happened and we all heard everyone's debrief, that's worth a lot. Because it's like, you know, when you build a house, you have a firm ground to build something on. If you have this perception, I have another one, we have like, you know, sand, kind of, it's, you know, it's moving. We have nothing firm to build, to construct a shared building on. So it's worth a lot, this kind of foundation. And that's exactly what social presencing theater does.
So I'll explain just briefly the method. I will call the name of the role and invite you to then step up if you'd like to embody this role. And
first one is national government.
Find a spot in the room, center, edge, wherever. Find a place and a shape that embodies, it says, some quality of that role. Remember that your embodiment can be, it's a level. It's a standing shape, it could be a sitting shape, it could be a lying down shape, right? Some things are bigger and taller than other things. So you have a choice of level, you have a choice of how far or close you are, both to the center, the edge, and to the other players. The first person, of course, doesn't have that choice, but after the first role is in, then where you place yourself in the space is in proximity. It's close to this one, it's far from this one. So that's part of your kind of almost a choice in terms of where you place yourself. And the third thing is which direction you're facing. Are you facing this one? Are you facing here? Those three things, level, distance, and facing. You're paying attention to the feel of that.
Youth.
It's all based on the feeling quality of what it feels like then to be in the system. So I'm going to ask person one, say the name, they come in, they find their place, their shape. From their shape, they say one sentence or one phrase from the I voice. Like, what does this shape have to say? And you just say that, right? So the person comes out, they find their shape, and then they say,
this is our time.
Whatever it is that first comes to your mind that comes out of this shape. And next person. So try to hold your shape. If you get tired, just stop and rest and then remake your shape. Person two, same way. They find a space in relationship to the whole space here, they find a shape, lying down, standing up, whatever. They say, their shape says something. One sentence. Person three, four, five, until we complete them. At the end of that, I'll just ask you if you feel like you need to shift or refine your place in the space to better embody the current reality. You have a little opportunity. Maybe I feel a little bit more like it's closer to this one or something like that. So you have a little time to shift yourself.
Direction or your.
Once you get shifted,
spatial relationship,
please stay still. That'll be sculpture one. Then really stay with that. Just listen into it. Listen to what does it feel like, this current reality. What does it feel like? Really take your time to sense into this.
Really sensing.
The more you can sink into the current feeling,
and then letting the current reality,
the more genuine a sense of movement will occur. So something, somewhere in this thing, it'll start to move. You know, a stuck situation is not sustainable, right? It will start, something won't hold up, something will start to move. once that happens, then you have like 4 minutes or so to move around. Again, you're just sensing where it is that you feel that the space is calling you. And then once you find an ending, there'll be an ending, it'll emerge, that things will start to shift and shift. Maybe there's a little pause, maybe it starts up again, then it'll stop. That's sculpture two. And then each person, in a clear and loud voice, say the name of your role.
I am the municipal government.
And then one sentence.
I'm nearer to the communities than I have ever been.
When they finish that, then those of us on the side, if you have one thing you would like to say also, just offer it up. They'll try to stay more or less in the space. And we'll see if people get tired, we can sit down. But then it's just open for generative conversation. Please stay close to what I see, open mind. What I feel, open heart, and what I did or what I saw happen, actually the concrete information. A little bit more loyalty to that than I'm interpreting it in this way. You know, there'll be meaning and interpretation, but try to stick as close as you can with the actual what happens. Clear? Okay.
I am the national government. And I feel much better than before.
If anyone on the space holders has one sentence to offer from the iVoice, please.
I see two energy centers. One here, one there, and then some residuals.
I saw something go from more distributed in the space to linear to round. I noticed the child went from being close to the ground to growing up and looking out. A change of focus and quite strong. The way we do it, and what I've learned is just to say that we appreciate the opportunity to be together, and then we step out of that. Now you can brush off, like in Qigong, you can brush yourself off a little if you'd like. And we again appreciate this openness of the space that has great potential for something to appear next.
And our final stop on this journey through modeling systems is somewhere completely different again. We're going to zoom out to a framework for thinking about changing systems over time. And time here might be years or decades or even longer. The framework we're going to look at is something called MLP, multi-level perspective. And it's the foundation for transition research, a research discipline that's looking at how systems change over time, often going back in time to look at how big changes happened in the past, for example, the adoption of certain kinds of fuel, and analyzing current changes, for example, uptake of renewables in different countries. My favorite paper on this topic is titled Analyzing the Breakthrough of Rock and Roll 1930 to 1970, using the MLP framework. And you're going to hear now from Frank Heels, who is one of the co-creators of the model.
From the bottom, we have niche innovations, which are the radical innovations that are the seed of transitions to sustainability, and that can be car sharing or electric vehicles or alternative foods. And they're struggling, they're usually emerging in the periphery in small niches, and they want to break through, but they're struggling against this deeply locked in existing system. And this struggle is being played out and influenced by the wider landscape. So I've got one slide on each of these levels. Again, I won't go in any depth, but one of the problems is not only looking at niches, but some of the basic problem is also stability. You know, transitions are ultimately about stability and change. And the problem, of course, is that the existing system, which has been there for a long time, is locked in and path dependent and resistant to change. And in various literatures, here you've got the economic, social, and political literatures, you have causal mechanisms that help explain the stability. So these can be vested interests or sunk investments or just scale advantages and low cost, but also cognitive routines and also opposition and power. So there's a whole range of literatures that emphasize or that analyze different kind of causal mechanisms that help explain why systems do not change radically, but more incrementally over time. Then the second level is the niche level that explains more where do radical innovations come from, because they all are emerging from somewhere and then you can track the development over time. And the idea is that innovations initially emerge in the periphery. This is also an idea from evolutionary theory. And they cannot immediately compete on mainstream markets because usually their price performance characteristics are much lower than the existing technology. So Joel Moki called these hopeful monstrosities. So how can these hopeful monsters emerging in niches, how can they emerge and how can they develop over time and gain momentum to overthrow the existing regime? That's basically the core puzzle, I think, of transition studies. All this struggle is situated by a wider landscape, which you can either, there are slow changing secular trends, you know, demographics, macroeconomics, ideology, but also climate change, I think. But you also have shocks, of course, the oil shock, the recessions, wars, and now, of course, also the pandemic, which can really change the whole selection environment in which niches and regimes interact with each other. So when you put this all together in a more dynamic sense, and also you see this unfolding over time. So the radical innovations emerging in the left-hand corner, there's a lot of variety and flux and variation going on, lots of trial and error, also lots of failure, which is struggling against the existing regime, which is not entirely inert, but incrementally developing over time as represented with these straight horizontal lines. And then there's the broader landscape level, which usually tends to evolve much more slowly. So what Brodel calls the longer durée. And for this transition, well, I think many of you will have seen this picture, so I won't spend a lot of time. But the basic story is radical innovations emerge in small niches. There's a prolonged period of experimentation and learning and the building of networks and articulation of visions. It can easily take 20 to 30 years, but then gradually it stabilizes. There's more agreement about where to go. The visions become clearer. The price goes down. The performance becomes better. So then you get the struggle in the second and the third phase. How does it diffuse and how does it get into the existing system? And usually that involves also external pressures on the regime, which tend to overcome these deep-seated lock-ins and path dependencies. So these pressures then open up the regime, as you can see with those little arrows in the middle of the picture, that then creates windows of opportunity, and then those niche innovations can break through more widely and replace the existing regime. But the pathways I'll briefly talk about now are a further differentiation of this basic idea of technological substitution, and that there are also other ways of having large sustainability change. So technological substitution is basically the niche innovations emerge and we get a lot of substitution primarily on the technological dimension, and there may be some spillovers to the other dimension. So if we talk about battery electric vehicles, that's clearly a technology. So that is now beginning to diffuse and we see some substitution happening. And of course, that's then triggering further changes in infrastructure because you need recharging. It may also change user preferences, how people drive. It may lead to new cultural meanings. But it is really the idea of the one going up, electric vehicles in this example, and the other going down, petrol cars. And this is then often, you know, facilitated by a specific shock where if you look at the renewables in Germany, they were emerging for a long time, then you get the Fukushima shock, and all of a sudden you get the Energiewende as a formal policy and the diffusion goes faster. This is how many economists also in particular think about transitions. It's basically a substitution story. But we differentiated this in our 2007 paper and later also in 2016. You can also have quite a lot of change in the existing regime by the existing actors gradually reorienting their direction by changing the search routines, changing their investment strategies, changing the institutional logics. And then gradually with small changes over time, if you do it long enough, you can get a lot of improvement over time. And if you do this over a 30, 40 year periods, the existing regime may actually look quite different than the one you began with. Although there's never been a substitution, it's a much more gradual transformation, endogenously enacted. The third pathway is reconfiguration, where it's not new against old, it's actually the radical innovations emerging in niches being incorporated into the existing system, and then from there on triggering further learning processes and knock-on effects, and may even change the entire architecture of the system. So you might think renewables are being incorporated into the electricity system and are now changing the basic architecture in terms of a shift from centralized to decentralized. We need to change the grids in terms of backup capacity and storage, and also that there are more bidirectional flows in the whole electricity grid. So something that starts as basically technological substitution or partial substitution in the system can lead to all kind of knock-on effects. And this is more this is a pattern where new actors and old actors work together. So it's much more about new alliances rather than overthrow. And then the last one, which is maybe particularly relevant now with the corona crisis, is de-alignment and realignment, where major landscape pressures create such a major shock on the systems that the systems really destabilize, begin to fall apart, and that then creates basically a lot of open space for various niche innovations to emerge. And then we need to wait and see which one will win and will lead to a new realignment of the regime. So I'm sure we could probably talk later about what the coronavirus means in terms of these pathways, because you know it's not only a single shock. It's going to lead to a recession. It's going to lead to a whole range of other knock-on effects. And I think we still need to wait and see if it actually will destabilize. It's currently, of course, is destabilizing the systems, but if this will be a permanent destabilization, or if it will actually restabilize around the status quo. And of course, you see a lot of incumbent actors are pushing just for getting back to the status quo. So I think that whole idea of pathways is one big research area which is attracting a lot of attention. I think a second one is a more nuanced view of interactions between niches and regimes. And there's been quite a literature going back to 2007, Adrian Smith, who came up with some interesting mechanisms. So for instance, selective translation, that the incumbent players may selectively incorporate aspects of niche innovations into their existing regime. And he gave some examples of supermarkets, which initially did not have organic food, but then they see this as a growing market. So the existing supermarkets started adopting the idea of organic food into their regime, but more as a new product rather than a wider system transformation. Smith and Raven wrote a whole interesting paper about empowerment. So what niche actors do to try to actively change regime rules, and they further distinguish between fit and stretch patterns. Other way of nuancing the niche regime interaction are collaborations between new entrants and incumbents, but also the political struggles over institutional change. And sometimes that you have countervailing power from other regimes. So you got, for instance, some of the ICT companies, you know, which are big incumbent players in ICT, the Googles and those kind of players, they're moving into other regimes and thereby stimulating the niches. So they're moving into car manufacturing, into automotive, and they're moving into renewables. So I think there's a whole set of, and I've got some references at the bottom here, a whole set of more interesting mechanisms of how niches and regimes interact with each other. So there's a lot more debate now on politics in transitions, because obviously I mentioned that rules and institutions and standards are really crucial because they shape markets and they stimulate innovation. But of course, there are deep struggles about what these institutions are like. So there are struggles between the niche actors and the regime actors, because as I said, usually the rules and institutions are really favored to the existing regime. it's not a level playing field. So one of the struggles that you will have to do as a niche actor is to try to change the institutions. And here are some papers that are trying to do that. So Jochen Markert has written about this, and so have I with Roberts. There's a big literature on institutional entrepreneurship that can be mobilized. There's a whole literature now emerging on policy mixes. And Kern and Rocher wrote a really good overview paper, which I would really recommend to you if you're interested in policy process theories. So they talk about, you know, multiple streams models, garbage can models, policy network models. There's a whole range of theories in political science that we can mobilize and to understand the political struggles in transitions. Also, really active debate is about cultural meanings in particular, and discursive struggles. So that's about, you know, the struggles are not only about products and markets and politics, but also about sense making. And sense making really is important because it shapes meanings and therefore also cultural legitimacy. And there was a nice paper, very nice paper by Hermville, which I've got at the bottom there, Hermville 2016, which shows that Fukushima, the accident in 2011, was interpreted very differently in Japan, Germany, and the United Kingdom, framed in different terms, interpreted in different terms, and that had really different kind of political consequences. So in Germany, it was really seen as a confirmation that nuclear power is a lethal threat. Whereas in the UK, it was just framed as, well, you know, the Japanese had a different design and they don't manage their reactors very well, so we don't need to worry about it. So I'm just saying this to show that cultural meanings and discursive struggles really are influential and consequential for how transitions unfold. And there's a lot of literature on this. Again, I've got some at the bottom. Discursive struggles in the media is important. How landscape shocks are interpreted. I already gave you the example of Fukushima, but of course now the same is going on with the coronavirus. You know, how are we interpreting and framing this? Also interesting is the whole delegitimation of existing regimes. So the whole Dieselgate scandal in Germany, of course, has really deeply discredited Volkswagen, but also quite a couple of, because it was not only Volkswagen, also a range of other car companies. And has really, in the UK, led to a massive sales drop in diesel cars and companies saying we're going to phase out diesel and petrol cars. So the negative storylines that help delegitimate existing regimes are also a really important, interesting topic for us to study. And have been done in the MLP. Business struggles, as I already mentioned, this is a huge literature that is increasingly being mobilized because business and management is a massive field, of course. And we are increasingly going beyond the simple Schumpeterian dichotomy in which the incumbents are the bad guys, you know, and they are just stupid and they're just incremental and locked in. And the green guys, you know, they're the good ones. And they are doing all the radical innovation, the new entrants. And that's sometimes the case, but it's too simple and it's definitely not always the case. There are lots of niche innovations being developed by incumbents. So there's a whole literature that has strategic reorientation of incumbents towards niche innovations. Of course, the battery electric vehicles are partly done by new entrants like Tesla, but also by the existing car companies, as an example. But there's also a whole literature on corporate political strategies. So the incumbents, you know, they don't always actively reorient. They also try to resist and slow down and delay the transition as much as they can because they can gain billions by this. So that's the whole literature on corporate political strategies, what they do to influence policymakers by paying them, by sitting on committees, by threatening to close down factories, all these kind of things. And of course, these strategies are now heavily being played out with the whole coronavirus, and their active bailout strategies are really actively going on right now. How much money is going to go, you know, to the green innovations, and how much is going to go to basically propping up the car companies, the aviation companies, the oil industry? So these corporate political strategies is a really interesting and important area for research.
So this is a story of rock and roll that starts with the artists, Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, etc. But for Frank, that's too simple a story. Really, to understand rock and roll, using the multi-level perspective, we have to look at the complex interaction between demographic changes, niche radio stations, radios moving into the bedroom as television moved into the lounge, the invention of new musical instruments, notably the electric guitar, and the intersection between niche independent labels that launched rock and roll in the 50s and the mainstream regime labels that in the 60s converted themselves to the new musical style, technology and audience and were able to regain dominant market positions. The MLP model seems particularly relevant when we're thinking about big shifts in systems. And it made me wonder if we want to accelerate a transition that sees social innovation moving from the niche to the mainstream. What might we displace? How might it be co-opted by the existing regime? And what shocks might accelerate this?